Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, September 9th. We are learning more about the damage on Kauai and the plans to restore power to the island. We'll have the latest. We look ahead to the 25th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the East Coast, which claimed the lives of several people with Hawaii ties. We also chat with the director of a documentary about the oil industry ahead of several screenings this weekend on Oahu. And the sweet cuckooing of a city bird is featured on today's Manu Minute. And we hear more about a Japanese artist who left her mark across the world, including Hawaii, especially the complicated aspects of her life. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Little by little, power is being restored to the Garden Isle. KIUC, the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, is still cautioning that customers should plan on extended outages as repairs to its system are just getting underway. We get the latest from KIUC's Beth Amaro, who describes what their crew saw after a flyover yesterday.
We were able to get folks up in a helicopter so they could take that aerial view of our transmission system. We were really focusing on getting eyes on our transmission lines and poles to see what problems we have that we're going to have to fix. So we had a helicopter flyover. We also have a drone crew on island that we've used previously. We brought them in from the mainland over the weekend so they could help us do these inspections of our poles and lines using drones. And then we had a bunch of people out there on foot. And again, it's really at this early stage, this first step is the transmission system. So we have to get those repairs made to that system before we can even think about, you know, getting to restoring distribution circuits, basically, you know, people in their homes and businesses. And we got a good look at that yesterday. We were able to assess where all of the damage is. We are already working on restoring the transmission system. We were able to actually get a number of people on back into service since yesterday, about 9,000 of our members that are located closer to our Port Allen facility, which, you know, we were able again to make those transmission repairs there close to that generation plant and then restore members who are in that vicinity down in the areas of Old Mau, Lawaii, Eleele, and Hanapepe. So yeah, a very good productive day, and transmission repairs are underway today, and we'll hopefully have those complete by maybe tomorrow.
Well, I know that when we were talking with Hawaiian Electric about lessons learned with Hurricane Iniki, we talked about having enough poles in the state to be able to replace broken poles because of the damaging winds. And I don't know what the situation is over there. Do you have enough of those poles and transmission lines that you need?
For the past few years, prior to hurricane season, we have been stocking up in anticipation of a major event. We have been stocking up probably what we would estimate to be a one-month supply of pole replacements should we have a storm event. So we do have extra poles in inventory for this purpose, and we, for anything that we think we might need beyond that extra inventory, we are already getting that into the pipeline. And hopefully if we need more and we'll need them beyond a month or so, we will be able to bring those in and keep crews running so that we have no interruption just because of lack of inventory.
And then what can you tell us about, you know, the plants and the other infrastructure? You know, what kind of damages, you know, were caused by the high winds?
Yeah, our power generating facilities all appear to be fine. Minor damage, if anything. It's not keeping us from being able to generate power. That is not the problem right now. It's the transmission and distribution repairs. Power generation facilities are fine. We did have some damage to some of our substations, and that is also critical to this restoration effort. So those repairs are being prioritized this week, and hopefully we can get that done this week as well, so that, again, once we get our transmission repairs done, our substations are ready to go, then we can start working on the distribution circuits and actually getting people back up and running.
And then, you know, what can you tell us about your crews that you've out in the field, you know, addressing the down lines in heavily traversed areas, you know, because it's, you know, it's dangerous, right? You folks are being asked to not be on the road if they don't have to be.
Right. They're working very, very hard. A lot of this initial work, the transmission lines are not always, you know, they can be in remote areas, and so those can be difficult to get to, difficult to work in. Crews are working very, very hard. There are also those that run along our roadways. So keeping people off the roadways is helpful to us to be able to access those lines and do our work efficiently. But they are working extremely hard. They're extremely committed, and they take a lot of pride in being able to get our community back up and running. We also have a number of mainland contract crews that were brought in over the weekend, and more are coming. I want to say a special thank you to our friends at HECO, because they have committed to sending over some support for us, and I think that is in process and on the way. So we will absolutely definitely welcome our friends from HECO to help us get out there and get people back up and powered quickly.
Yes, you know, we know that folks are working very hard and around the clock just to get the service restored. But again, you know, as far as the critical, you know, medical facilities, that kind of thing, I mean, do they have emergency power?
Yes, most of our facilities do have adequate emergency power. They plan for this so that they can keep running. But we are hopeful that we can get, you know, these areas, for example, Lihue, we have so many critical facilities located right here in Lihue, our ports, our airports, our hospital, our government offices. So once we get to that point of being able to restore at the distribution level, we will be prioritizing those areas for sure. We'll be prioritizing areas with, you know, the highest density population. But, you know, that is not to say that we won't get into any area that is ready to go, and especially with supplemental crews here, you know, we will be able to hopefully bring people online again in a very efficient manner. And we don't really have a timeline at this point. We are hoping in the next couple of days that will become much clearer. We would love to be able to get to the point where we can say tomorrow, you know, we'll be working on such and such area, and we expect that we'll have 50% or 100% restored by the end of the day. That is our goal, to get to that point as soon as possible. And maybe by the end of this week, we'll be able to put out our daily report and actually have that type of specificity. We are putting out news releases every day around 4 o'clock in the afternoon to recap what's been happening during the day, and then to talk about what our next priorities are. So we really encourage our members to listen to their media for those updates in the evening, or go to our website under our news release page and check out the latest information.
Well, you know, we often, you know about topping off our vehicles if we don't have electric vehicles, but, you know, just those kinds of things. And if those service stations don't have electricity, you know, their pumps probably don't work. So it's all tied together.
Correct. Absolutely. And, you know, that now that you mentioned that, Catherine, one thing we wanted to just put out there, because we know that people are starting to fire up generators and to give themselves some relief and give themselves power at home. Please be careful with these generators. They can be very dangerous if you don't use them properly. So, you know, you don't want to bring them into an enclosed space. And, you know, just know how to safely use a generator. Use it safely. We just don't want anything to happen that doesn't need to happen at this point. Things are already as challenging as they need to be without folks risking their own safety or their neighbor's safety by misusing a generator.
Yes, and I know I just learned this summer, I went home to Guam, and you know they were hit by a couple of super typhoons this year, and I learned that one of my classmates, my high school classmates, died because of that very thing, and that's heartbreaking to hear because, you know, fatalities are so rare, and if we just remind each other about best practices, you know, when the winds are destructive, you know, I heard in Tinian they're having to rebuild the power plant from scratch. They have to start again. Yeah. And so you have extended periods of blackouts and people just need to mentally prepare for that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, every one of us, I mean, just know everyone at KIUC is also without power, right? So it really does create, you have to reset your mindset. You know, your morning routine is very different, right? And you have to just plan ahead and think about how to do things a little differently. Know that there are certain things that you're used to doing every day that you just can't for now. So it's a mental reset as well. And I know our mayor talks constantly about looking out for your mental health as well as everything else. And that's super important. I'm so heartened to see in our communities how everybody is banding together. Myself, I went home last night for the first time since the onset of the storm. And, you know, in our neighborhood, you know, everybody is walking around talking to each other, making sure we're okay. Maybe what comes out of this as a positive is we're all a little more closely connected and we're all reminded that, you know, to look out for each other. So that's important too. Take care of your mental and emotional needs as well as your physical needs.
Yes, and to really take to heart the messages from our emergency management officials because it's important stuff. People need to be prepared, whether it's, you know, charging your phones or charging your electric vehicles or whatever. You have that anxiety that comes along with the uncertainty of not knowing when you will have power restored. But we just have to cope as best we can and help each other.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
That was KIUC's Beth Amaro, who we talked to just within the last hour or so. Look for updates on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. The extraordinary reach of New York Times journalism brings you the sound and the story. Times reporters unpack more of what you want to know about our nation and our world as it happens. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
The National Park Service this week dedicated a memorial in a Pennsylvania field where Flight 93 crashed during a 9/11 hijacking attempt 25 years ago. Crew members had tried to thwart a hijacking of the plane, which some say was going to be diverted to the nation's capital, just one of several targets that day. Commemoration ceremonies are also being held across the country for those who lost their lives during the 9/11 terrorist attacks at the Pentagon and at the World Trade Center. Hawaii's Mike Latham was in New York teaching at Fordham University at the time. He's now president of Punahou School and was a classmate of one of the victims, Richard Lee. Lee worked at the financial firm Cantor Fitzgerald, which had its headquarters in the World Trade Center and which lost 658 people, nearly two-thirds of its workforce that day. Punahou will be marking the anniversary with a small private ceremony on campus for not just one, but two of its alumni.
Punahou will be commemorating and really, really remembering two of our graduates, Rich Lee, class of 1986, and Heather Ho, class of 1987. And, you know, these were two people who were really beloved at the school and went on to have really kind of amazing careers before they were tragically killed, really at the prime of their lives in their early 30s.
Yes, and, you know, I just think of just the loss that everybody felt, because it was just really unimaginable to think what had unfolded on television as we were watching.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think you look at somebody like Rich, 34 years old at the time that he was killed, a devoted father of a young son who was about to turn two, and a person just of incredible energy and enthusiasm. I knew him as a classmate here at Punahou. He was a football player, in fact, the captain of Punahou's football team, one of the captains. 6 feet, 4 inches tall, which I felt like he was that tall in seventh grade. You know, I mean, this was a really person of incredible physical stature, but really brilliant, creative, you know, punk rock guitarist, devoted to his friends, went on to Yale, studied political science there, studied Russian language, just an incredibly brilliant, energetic guy who went on to have a career in finance, working for Cantor Fitzgerald, actually, in charge of their equities technology. And to see someone like that lose their life at that moment is devastating. Heather, only 32, another really amazing individual, graduated from Boston University, studied at the Culinary Institute of America, was working as a pastry chef at a number of really prominent Manhattan restaurants, and then at the time she was killed, she was actually working at Windows on the World there at the World Trade Center. You know, a person who was aspiring to have her own business, a person with a great deal of entrepreneurial drive and creativity. And yeah, it's tragic, even 25 years later, to look back. It's a sad moment to recognize the loss.
And you were there in New York City at that time.
I was, yeah. I was working as a professor at Fordham University in New York, and I was working in the Bronx on that day where Fordham's main campus is. And, you know, I'd come in, it was a gorgeous, beautiful September day, clear blue sky, low humidity. And I'd come in and was, you know, was working and taking some phone calls, and a colleague told me a plane had hit the World Trade Center, and I thought, surely that can't be right. And then I thought, well, maybe it was maybe a Cessna, some small aircraft. And then I was on the sixth floor of the building where I was working. And so I went down. At the end of the hall, there was a conference center, conference room facing south that you could look down into Manhattan. And it was such a clear day that from where we were on the sixth floor there, you could see the 12 or 15 miles south into Manhattan where the World Trade Center was. And this horrible sight of the buildings themselves burning. And, you know, it's one of those moments where you can't quite believe what you're seeing, and there's a sense of confusion. And then, of course, the sheer horror of realizing that so many mothers and fathers, sons, daughters were being lost. And the sense of anguish that provokes, certainly very strong at Fordham, of course, because so many of our employees and their kids were all people with long histories in New York, and so they all had many friends, colleagues, and relatives who were at the buildings on that day.
Yes, and as I was going back and rereading some of these stories, to think that Cantor Fitzgerald lost, oh my gosh, so many of their staffers from that one office.
Yeah, that's right.
Stunning. And it changed the landscape or the skyline of New York, and it changed all of our lives.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think our sense of security, vulnerability, I think was forever altered. The way that we travel, the way that we assess risk, certainly it altered the, you know, that psychological landscape for everyone. That's for sure.
Yes. I mean, you know, there's so many people that look at that event and say, okay, what are the lessons learned, and how can we avoid this in the future?
Right, yeah.
But just the acknowledgement of the lives lost, of the people who were loved.
Yeah, yeah. I think that counts for a lot. You know, it took me a long time before I was actually ready to go to the memorial itself. It said the gradual sense of recognition of what had taken place. I was living in Westchester County, New York, and lots of people were commuting into Manhattan every day, riding the train. And there were these parking lots next to all of these train stations. And it was just kind of horrifying to see over the next several weeks that there were cars in these lots that just never moved. And you began to realize that these were cars which had been driven by people who had gone in to work in the city, and they had never returned. And so it was this visible reminder of loss. But I have to say, when I finally was able to go and visited the memorial, I found it really affirming that the reflection in terms of the names of those lost, the memories collected there, that was a way for them to, I think almost in a commemorative and even sort of a defiant way, to say that, we're not gone, that no act is going to remove their presence. And I think it was in some ways very affirming to see that. And I think our charge then is to continue to remember them and to try to figure out how to live in such a way that we honor their memory.
I remember when I saw that memorial for the first time. And, I think the fact that you use that event, and when you talk to the students there at Punahou about the mark that their lives can make on the world, right?
Yeah.
However short, that they put that passion into making this a better place.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, they've been, I think all of these students have been given something remarkably, remarkably precious. The opportunity to, as you say, to go out and try to make a real contribution to the community they're a part of. And I think perhaps, recognizing some of the fragility of life is a poignant reminder of the importance of that.
And so talk about what you folks will do at your ceremony.
So we have some opening prayers, which are led by one of our chaplains, George Scott, who is our academy chaplain. Really a wonderful preacher, really thoughtful and reflective, I think drawing on scripture and calling us into a more reflective space, in the midst of everybody's busy lives, intentionally stopping to reflect and to pray. Our JROTC unit will be there in a color guard. And we typically will drape lay as a gesture of memorial over the photographs of Rich and Heather as a way for current students to recognize those who had gone before them that were here and made a contribution to this place. And oftentimes we have students playing taps as well, which is, again, I think adds to that space, that reflective space in the midst of oftentimes what turns out to be such a busy campus, that this attempt to really stop and reflect and remember in the midst of that.
Yes, and there will be ceremonies like that across the country as we remember those we lost.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard to believe it's been 25 years. I think it's a reminder to us that these are people whose lives we want to remember, and all of those who were lost on that day.
Yes, well, we will think of the family of Heather and Rich this week and on Friday, as well as the family of all the other folks who perished in that event with Hawaii Ties.
Absolutely. Thank you, Catherine. Pleasure to talk with you.
And on Friday, Latham will also be thinking of another Hawaii resident who he knew who died that day. Miley Hale was the valedictorian of Kaiser High School, and Latham said he used to live in the same neighborhood in Hawaii Kai and used to cut her family's grass as a teenager. Kaiser has planted a tree with a plaque to honor her memory. Hale was in New York for a seminar. And another ceremony will be held to remember Christine Schneider. She was an arborist and was attending a conference and was on the flight that crashed in that Pennsylvania field. Trees have been planted in her honor, and the Hawaii Outdoor Circle is planning a small ceremony tomorrow morning to remember her. The city and state will hold its ceremony honoring the first responders who died in the attack Friday evening at the Eternal Flame on Baratania Street. And a programming note, on Friday, we will air a special 9/11 show produced by NPR. It'll be hosted by Mary Louise Kelly at 11 a.m. during the conversation slot.
Support for HPR comes from Scale Staffing, providing offshore staffing and recruitment for audit, finance, and accounting functions. Learn more about services at scalestaffing.co.
25 years ago, Frank Donadeo and thousands of others rushed to help on 9/11. Years later, many got sick.
People live with the why me when something bad happens. I can honestly tell you that I often ask myself, why not me?
Frank was a firefighter back then.
And then sure enough, it was me.
Why responders keep getting sick on the next Reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Ho'olanapua, working to prevent child trafficking through public education about buyer demand and the community's role in reducing exploitation. Resources at ho'olanapua.org.
Gaslit is a production that debuted at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival in February of this year. It won the award for Best Documentary. The film will be screened locally this weekend at two events. It follows actor and activist Jane Fonda across Texas and the Gulf Coast, and it takes a critical look at the liquefied natural gas industry. Take a listen to the trailer.
Wow. Now those huge clouds, is that methane?
So this must be an LNG plant.
This is unbelievable.
You know, we got a chance to talk to the film's director, Katie Kamasi, this morning. She did work with the Greenpeace Project on the Pacific Garbage Patch. Here's Katie.
So I've been with Greenpeace making videos across the U.S. and on their ships for about a decade now. And that's how I met Jane Fonda. So Jane and Greenpeace for several years worked on a project called Fire Drill Fridays. They had a lot of different permutations, but one of those during the height of the pandemic was a virtual video series, like a talk show almost, where she brought on different impacted community leaders, impacted from climate change, extreme weather, living near fossil fuels. And then about 4 years ago, Jane and I went in person down to the Gulf Coast, down to Port Arthur, Texas, and we met a man named John Beard, who's in Gaslit. And we learned about these LNG terminals, you know, these liquefied natural gas. We don't like the term natural, but fracked gas terminals. And it was right next to this plastic production and all this other industry. And that really was the start of it. Jane and I were really shocked by what we saw, by all the pollution, by the health impacts, and of course the climate impacts. And we started a project where we met all these different communities and individuals living along the Gulf Coast, and that eventually became Gaslit.
So talk about the title, Gaslit.
Yes. So not only are we talking about gas and, you know, oil and gas, fossil fuel industry, we're really talking about a lot of misinformation, and this is happening at different levels. So in the film, you're going to see people across the political divide from all walks of life, but who all have a similar story, that when industry wants to come in or near your community, they make a lot of promises. And what these people found is that those promises were not fulfilled. So some of those promises were about, you know, we're going to keep the air and the water and everything clean. We care about the environment. And then you'll hear from people like Sharon Wilson and Diane Wilson and all these people who have found that that's not true, but these companies can afford to pay the fines if they do go over, you know, the pollution limits. There were also a lot of promises of jobs, but they found that those jobs were primarily construction jobs. And once the construction went away, there were very few jobs in the community. So, well, the reason to make it is really for people, which is most of us, who have industry already in our communities are wanting to come in, especially like with what is happening in Hawaii right now, and to kind of let them have a reality check and know what the truth is that's away from the PR spin of these companies.
You know, and I imagine, you know, communities, they hear one thing and then the reality may be different. And then they are doubting, am I imagining this? You know, is there something going on here that we don't know enough about? And so I mean, you know, like I said, the title is just packed with so much. I mean, the fact that you're now bringing this film, you know, here to Hawaii.
Yes, we've got a couple. We've got a couple screenings. One of them is on Friday, September 11th at the Honolulu Museum of Art. That one is actually sold out, so they've added a second screening on September 12th in the evening, and that one is at the Patagonia Haleiwa. And there are still tickets there, and tickets are free, so you can go onto gaslit.com, onto the watch page. Sorry, gaslitdoc.com. There's a watch page there, and get tickets. And you're going to have the film, but also a panel discussion afterwards. And one of the people, Melanie Oldham, has come from Freeport, Texas, a place that has one of these LNG terminals already. In fact, there was an explosion there a few years ago, so she can talk about that. And also the Sierra Club's director in Hawaii will be there, and a local person from Oahu who was a youth plaintiff in the historic climate lawsuit and settlement that was achieved. So there'll be a really great discussion. They'll take questions from the audience, and yeah, I think it'll be a really informative and engaging evening.
And what is it that you hope to lay out on the table, let's say, for folks that maybe haven't formed an opinion one way or the other about LNG? We're hearing certainly lots about it. And, you know, with that one Japanese company that's expressed a desire to set up shop here, JERA. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're watching this very cautiously. Yeah. They see that some say, well, this is a bridge because we can't just go to green energy directly. But some say, no, this is not, you know, the answer. You know, environmentalists are pushing back on this and they are calling for transparency about this deal. You know, so, yeah, what do you hope to present in this film?
So what I hope people get out of it is hearing from community members and folks they might relate to. So, you know, this has a lot of different people in it, including ranchers in Texas and shrimpers and oystermen in Louisiana, people that you might not think are spending time with environmentalists. And I kind of like that, you know, unlikely allies who might disagree on things but can agree on this. And I think if you're going to make a decision on something big like this, that I've heard that argument that it's a bridge fuel, but what I've really heard from people who live around here is they're investing so much really to keep us in this age of fossil fuels. You know, they're trying to lock in the countries who are buying the LNG from the Gulf. You know, they want these 10, 20-year contracts. So, you know, I hope that in addition to hearing what the companies have to say, what the PR firms have to say, I think it's important to hear from folks who've lived it and kind of see what their life is like before making a decision that is this significant.
Well, you know, I know people may be skeptical. You know, they see the push on both sides, right? Is it spin? Sure. Is it propaganda? What's the truth? You know, what are the facts? And mm-hmm. how can we use that information to make an informed decision for our state and our communities?
Absolutely. And you're going to get a lot of that information in the film. What I'm really proud of is, yes, we have Jane Fonda. We also have singer-songwriter Maggie Rogers and some other friends of Jane in there. But they're really what I see as an audience avatar or a tour guide of the film. What I'm really proud of in Gaslit is that the story and the information is told by the people who live in these areas. So we're not talking to campaigners or people from the coast or from somewhere else. We're talking to the people who live and work in that region, and not just one or two people. You know, I think you're going to see, gosh, it's probably like 20 to 30 people get featured in there, which was really intentional, right? Because that's what, when Jane and I went down there, it wasn't just like, oh, this person has an issue. It really felt like everyone, everywhere we went along that coast, everything from the environmental degradation to the health impacts, and then, of course, the larger concerns about if we are locking in fossil fuels, what's that going to do to our climate, which impacts everyone.
Was there anything that surprised you that you didn't know about LNG, you know, before you even started this project, you know, and now that it's completed and you're taking it around? I don't know. What can you share with our listeners?
There were a number of things I didn't know. In fact, I didn't really understand what it was till I got there. But probably what shocked me the most, you're going to see at the beginning of the film, we start in the biggest oil and gas drilling field in the U.S. It's in West Texas, where there's been a ton of fracking and where they're fracking this gas that will become liquid and sent to other countries. And it's that exporting to other countries that really was one of the things that really shocked me. So every hydrocarbon that is extracted in the Permian goes to these other countries, which not only, you know, you'll see in the film, we go to Germany, which is one of the places that imports this gas from the Gulf, and they've banned fracking in their own country. And that feels, you know, people in the film would find that a little hypocritical. Like, if fracking, if you're not willing to do it because of risk to health and the environment, then why are you buying our fracked gas? And then also that's raising the cost of energy globally. So, you know, nobody's benefiting except these companies, as John Allaire in the film talks about, you know, and he's a former oil and gas guy, retired now, but who worked in all levels. And he said if it were staying domestic, you know, he might not have as much of an issue, but it's the exports that really bother him. And, you know, I think you're going to hear a lot of different opinions like that, where they might come at it from a different angle. But I think it does matter a lot more to hear from real folks and not necessarily spokespeople.
That was Katie Camosi, director of the film Gaslit, which will be screened at two events here on Oahu this weekend. And for those who can't attend, Camosi says it will be available to stream on Prime Video later this month. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
After 9/11, the so-called War on Terror reshaped the U.S. government. Agencies that oversee border control and immigration became much more militarized.
With immigration enforcement sort of folded into this umbrella of homeland security and counterterrorism, this immediate conflation happened, right?
Hear more about that next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Halau of O'ewi Art in Wailuku, Maui, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. For this week's Mono Minute, Patrick Hart shares the sweet cuckooing of the ubiquitous zebra dove, thanks to the Makaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
If you've ever sat down at an outdoor park bench or table for a snack anywhere across Hawaii, you've probably noticed zebra doves darting around on the ground looking for crumbs of food. Zebra doves are about 8 inches in length, but only weigh about 2 ounces. These little doves are brownish-gray on their backs and have fine black and white bars on the sides of their breast that look a little bit like zebra stripes. If you look real close, you'll notice that the center part of their breast is a pretty pinkish-brown color. Zebra doves are native to Southeast Asia and were first introduced to Hawaii in the 1920s. Since then, they've become widespread in the main Hawaiian Islands, and are commonly found in cities, towns, and countrysides, where they forage mainly on small seeds and fruits. Their soft, pleasant cooing calls are a very common part of our soundscape. Zebra dove cooing competitions have become very popular in Thailand and other Southeast Asian countries, where the doves are judged by the melody, range, and loudness of their coos. The best cooing doves can bring their owners very large cash prizes. Because of this, breeding them has become big business, and the best cooing birds can sell for many thousands of dollars per pair. Here in Hawaii, our overlooked little zebra doves can draw attention to themselves during breeding season, when the males follow the females around on the ground incessantly bowing, cooing, and flaring their tail feathers in order to impress them. Because they're monogamous and generally mate for life, these displays must be very effective. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society's Welcome Home Kolea Festival, September 19th at Ala Moana Beach, open to all in the community. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
HPR is your trusted source for news and information by day, and your destination for music to unwind at night, starting with jazz in the evenings.
Welcome to Evening Jazz on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's time for the real deal. Good evening, I'm Seth Marco.
Stay up past your bedtime for After Hours.
Welcome to After Hours. You're about to enjoy the Mundo Reggae Show.
Well, it's Thursday all over again, and here I am, Jeff Long. The show is After Hours Country Detours.
Then finish off with some tunes from the underground.
Now time for a bucket full of blues, and hopefully you don't touch that dial. We've got thrills and chills to take you into the wee hours of the morning. It's Blues from the Basement coming right up.
HPR is your favorite hotspot, serving up the soundtrack for your evenings. Let's keep moving forward together. Donate at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Japanese artist Yayoi Kusama lived a life full of color, patterns, and polka dots. HPR's Cassie Ordonio comes to us live in the studio to talk about her legacy, the good, the bad, and what her career reveals about racial stereotypes in the art world. Good morning, Cassie.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
You know, when I think of how to describe her work, it's really eye-popping.
I only knew of Yayoi Kusama as the polka dot lady. Okay. That's all I remember. And then doing more research about her, I didn't realize that she has her large-scale installation at the Ala Moana Center at the Eva Wing called The Pumpkin. It's like this six-foot-tall sculpture, bronze sculpture of a pumpkin with polka dots. And apparently that's her signature is not just the polka dots, but the pumpkin to kind of replicate and reminisce on her time during World War II. Growing up in Japan with her family, and that's all they had to eat was pumpkins at that time. Hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, she's a very complicated person. She's a very talented artist, as I've been seeing, and there are many artists who have been mourning her death while remembering her legacy as well. When I spoke to Tyler Kahn, who's a senior curator of modern contemporary art at the Honolulu Museum of Art, he spoke about Kusama's impact on contemporary art, especially her radical performances and installations in the late 1950s. That's when she was living in New York at the time. And he even talked about the significance behind her signature polka dot.
For Kusama, that multiplying those dots as becoming polka dots that cover every single surface, including your own body, is a way of transcending yourself. Or she called it self-obliteration. And these infinity rooms where everything is fractured that you can't necessarily tell what is right in front of you or what is, you know, beyond, when your image itself is so fractured, for Kusama, this was really about a kind of dissolution of the ego, let's say. There is this fundamental contradiction where, you know, people enter these infinity rooms, you know, perhaps even looking for transcendence, and the first thing they do is take out their phone and take a selfie. So this way in which her work contains these sort of contradictions of affirmation of existence and dissolution, but also this radical art movement that was set itself against the painting as a commodity, also became so closely associated with luxury brands and multi-million dollar auction prices and things like this. I don't think this is really a case of Kusama selling out, as it were, but I think it's important to think about how art can mirror something in our society. And we look to contemporary art to both mirror and shape how we look at contemporary life. And so that sort of contradiction itself within Kusama's work, I think, can tell us a lot about our contemporary world.
That's a very thoughtful description of her work.
I had no idea like there was more significance behind her polka dot. And for those who haven't seen her work quite yet, other than at Ala Moana Center, is Yayoi's work is going to be exhibited at HOMA's upcoming exhibit called Vital Connections, Art and the Brain. And what people are going to see is a screen print, which is a composition of Kusama's trademark black dots in an orange background. And that was a gift from a art collector who has been a longtime HOMA member.
Yeah, and that's about how art helps with healing.
Exactly. Right? There is something about Kusama's work that really drew people to her and her work. It's like those vibrant, fun colors. And there's something about her art installation that's the Infinity Mirror Rooms, is where, you know, people become part of the artwork. You get to go into those infinity rooms, which is like full of vibrant colors and her signature polka dots, of course. And it's just kind of like either a selfie opportunity that Tyler Kahn has explained to me, but also the intentionality and connectedness to nature of why people are so connected to her work. And when I talked to Catherine Ann Leilani Tudor, you know, I didn't know she was a co-founder and the first executive director of the Honolulu Biennial Foundation, which is now Hawaii Contemporary, that produces Hawaii Triennial. And, you know, Kusama's work was actually introduced in Hawaii for the first time through the Honolulu Biennial, according to Tudor. There was a 2016 preview at the IBM building at the courtyard in Ward Village. Then also another one in 2017. It was an art installation at Foster Botanical Garden. But for Tudor, it was Kusama's work being connected to nature and the use of vibrant colors is what really drew her. And also, she said it's so hard to describe her 7 decades of Kusama's work.
She was such a pioneer in terms of being one of the most leading and popular women artists in the world. And so the obstacle she overcame in order to do that, the time that she did that, I think was incredibly inspiring for other women artists and women of color. And then just her continued success, the reception that she had at exhibits around the world, from Brazil to New York to Tokyo in Hawaii as part of the biennial, just showed how much people responded to her work. I remember one of the folks who visited in 2016 said, "I never thought that I'd ever be able to see Kusama in person." And so like just what it meant for people to experience her work in person really showed her reach around the world.
She's had a rather complicated legacy. Amid her death, there has been renewed discourse over her remarks of what she said in her 2002 autobiography about Black people. She described them as primitive, exotic beings, and you know, she didn't really see them as people. And I want to give credit to Dexter of Vice, who actually like wrote about her and interviewed her until she, you know, canceled the interview when it kicked him out of like her studio at that time back in 2017. It does beg the question of how do you separate the artists and their work while holding them accountable for what they said about a community. And when I spoke to Ethan Caldwell, who's an ethnic studies professor at the University of Hawaii, he said he's always been perplexed in the context of, you know, you're oftentimes taught to think about the artist and the art piece and the context in which it's created. But that context has a longstanding tradition of following some sort of stereotypical trope.
Are we trying to double down on it to make a point and in some ways confirm a truth? And in doing so, is that in the spirit of the art that you actually want to create? And if it is, then we should recognize it as such and then also say, but why are you doing this? And what do you have to gain from it? In some ways, it almost reminds me of when, you know, folks will play up particular stereotypes, you know, in literature or television and other cultural productions that they then are able to gain notoriety and clout from the denigration and the promotion of these essentialisms about Black folks or, you know, whatever other targeted group. And this is not to say that during those times it was permissible then, nor should it be permissible now. Sometimes I also feel like when it comes to issues surrounding like Black people being depicted, that's when we hesitate. And is the hesitation because this is a longstanding tradition within the art world and many other institutions? And the other part is, if that is the case, then why haven't these institutions also changed with the times and actually addressed these issues head on? If the artist is too big, then are we then putting more importance on the artist and the legacy versus the pain that is coming from their depictions or their work, especially against groups who don't hold the same kind of power nor clout?
So she does have this complicated legacy, and she did apologize for her racist remarks back in 2023 when she had an exhibit at SF MoMA. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of community members out there who still remember what she said. And this has been causing conversations in art institutions of how to balance upholding an artist's legacy while also holding them accountable for what they've said about a community.
Yeah, interesting. But yeah, fascinating artist. Thank you for highlighting that. We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio, our culture and arts reporter. You can look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. We are all out of time. Tomorrow, we do plan to keep tabs on storm damage as we get a little bit of a break before the next weather disturbance comes our way. Got a storm story to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.